Until he was 40, he did indeed live a particularly undistinguished life in Mecca as the husband of a prosperous wife. There may be some ground for the supposition that he became partner in a business in agricultural produce. To anyone visiting Mecca about AD 600, he would probably have seemed something of a loafer, a rather shy, good-looking individual sitting about and listening to talk, a poor poet, and an altogether second-rate man. About his internal life we can only speculate. Imaginative writers have supposed that he had great spiritual struggles, that he went out into the desert in agonies of doubt and divine desire. In the silence of the desert night, in the bright heat of noontide desert day, he, as do all men, had known and felt himself alone, yet not in solitude, for the desert is of God, and in the desert no man may deny him. Maybe that was so, but there's no evidence of any such desert trips. Yet he was certainly thinking deeply of the things about him. Possibly he had seen Christian churches in Syria. Almost certainly he knew much of the Jews and their religion, and he heard their scorn for this black stone of the Kaaba that ruled over the 300-odd tribal gods of Arabia. He saw the pilgrimage crowds, and noted the threads of insincerity and superstition in the paganism of the town. It oppressed his mind. The Jews had perhaps converted him to a belief in the one true God without his knowing what had happened to him. At last he could keep these feelings to himself no longer. When he was 40 he began to talk about the reality of God, at first apparently only to his wife and a few intimates. He produced certain verses, which he declared had been revealed to him by an angel. They involved an assertion of the unity of God, and some acceptable generalizations about righteousness. He also insisted upon a future life, the fear of hell for the negligent and evil, and the reservation of paradise for the believer in the one God. Except for his claim to be a new prophet, there doesn't seem to have been anything very new about these doctrines at the time, but this was seditious teaching for Mecca, which partly subsisted upon its polytheistic cult, and which was therefore holding on to idols when all the rest of the world was giving them up. Like Mani, Muhammad claimed that the prophets before him, and especially Jesus and Abraham, had been divine teachers, but that he crowned and completed their teaching. Buddhism, however, he didn't name, probably because he'd never heard of Buddha. Desert Arabia was in a theological backwater. For some years, the new religion was the secret of a small group of simple people. Khadija, the prophet's wife, Ali, an adopted son, Zaid, a slave, and Abu Bakr, a friend and admirer. For some years it was an obscure sect in a few households of Mecca, a mere scowl and muttering at idolatry, so obscure and unimportant that the leading men of the town didn't trouble about it in the least. Then it gathered strength. Muhammad began to preach more openly, to teach the doctrine of a future life, and to threaten idolaters and unbelievers with hell fire. He seems to have preached with considerable effect. It appeared to many that he was aiming at a sort of dictatorship in Mecca, and drawing many susceptible and discontented people to his side, and an attempt was made to discourage and suppress the new movement. Mecca was a place of pilgrimage and a sanctuary. No blood could be shed within its walls. Nevertheless, things were made extremely disagreeable for the followers of the new teacher. Boycott and confiscation were used against them. Some were driven to take refuge in Christian Abyssinia. But the prophet himself went unscathed because he was well connected, and his opponents didn't want to begin a blood feud. We can't follow the fluctuations of the struggle here, but it's necessary to note one perplexing incident in the new prophet's career, which, says Sir Mark Sykes, proves him to have been an Arab of the Arabs. After all his insistence upon the oneness of God, he wavered. He came into the courtyard of the Kaaba and declared that the gods and goddesses of Mecca might, after all, be real, might be a species of saints with a power of intercession. His recantation was received with enthusiasm, but he had no sooner made it than he repented, and his repentance shows that he had indeed the fear of God in him. His lapse from honesty proves him honest. He did all he could to repair the evil he had done. He said that the devil had possessed his tongue, and denounced idolatry again with renewed vigour. The struggle against the antiquated deities, after a brief interval of peace, was renewed again more grimly, and with no further hope of reconciliation. For a time, the old interests had the upper hand. At the end of 10 years of prophesying, Muhammad found himself a man of 50, and altogether unsuccessful in Mecca. Khadija, his first wife, was dead, and several of his chief supporters had also recently died. He sought a refuge at the neighboring town of Taif, but Taif drove him out with stones and abuse. Then, when the world looked darkest to him, opportunity opened before him. He found he had been weighed and approved in an unexpected quarter. The city of Medina was much torn by internal dissension, and many of its people during the time of pilgrimage to Mecca had been attracted by Muhammad's teaching. Probably the numerous Jews in Medina had shaken the ancient idolatry of the people. An invitation was sent to him to come and rule in the name of his God in Medina. He didn't go at once. He parleyed for 2 years, sending a disciple to preach in Medina and destroy the idols there. Then he began sending such followers as he had in Mecca to Medina to await his coming there. He didn't want to trust himself to unknown adherents in a strange city. This exodus of the faithful continued until at last only he and Abu Bekr remained. In spite of the character of Mecca as a sanctuary, he was very nearly murdered there. The elders of the town evidently knew of what was going on in Medina, and they realized the danger to them if this seditious prophet presently found himself master of a town on their main caravan route to Syria. Custom must bow to imperative necessity, they thought, and they decided that, blood feud or no blood feud, Muhammad must die. They arranged that he should be murdered in his bed, and in order to share the guilt of this breach of sanctuary, they appointed a committee to do this, representing every family in the city except Muhammad's own. But Muhammad had already prepared his flight, and when in the night they rushed into his room, they found Ali, his adopted son, sleeping, or feigning sleep, on his bed. The flight, the Hajara, was an adventurous one, the pursuit being pressed hard. Expert desert trackers sought for the spoor to the north of the town, but Muhammad and Abu Bekr had gone south to certain caves where camels and provisions were hidden, and thence he made a great detour to Medina. There he and his faithful companion arrived and were received with great enthusiasm on September the 20th, 622. It was the end of his probation and the beginning of his power. Third, until the Hijra, until he was 51, the character of the founder of Islam is a matter of speculation and dispute. Thereafter, he's in the light. We discover a man of great imaginative power, but tortuous in the Arab fashion, and with most of the virtues and defects of the Bedouin.